Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Who doesn't like a true crime story? I mean, we've talked about Charles Manson, we've talked about Jeffrey Dahmer, we talked about John Wayne Gacy, but have you ever heard of Belle Gunness? Well, today we're going to find out who she was. She was one of the most notorious serial killers of the 19th century, and one of the few women that were considered a serial killer. Thought to be at least 14 victims, we're going to find out how she lured people into her home, why she murdered, and we're going to have one of the world's biggest true crime authors who specializes in serial killers. We have Professor Harold Schechter is bringing his research to the paper and his paper to Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios for the first time, true crime author and Professor Harold Schechter. Hello, hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. It's an honor to have you here with all the books that you've written. I don't know how you have time to do anything else.
You know, I always tell people I'm a human dynamo between 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. That's when I get all my writing done. So leaves me plenty of time to do other stuff.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well then maybe it's just me that takes, you know, 6 hours to write a thank you note. So
that is a long time.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you for being here, and I'm excited to have you here to talk about your book, Hell's Princess, the mystery of Belle Gunness and Butcher of Men. So first of all, let's just jump right in and find out, who is Belle? Who's this woman of the 19th century that became one of the most notorious serial killers?
Yeah. Well, she was a Norwegian immigrant who came over here in her early 20s. She was born in a small hamlet, a farming hamlet in Norway. You know, grew up, had a really hard scrabble childhood. Mm-hmm. Her sister had preceded her to America and settled in Chicago. And when Belle was around 23, which would have been 1880 or something like that, she came over here and joined her sister in Chicago, worked as a domestic for a while. You know, and coming from the kind of poverty-stricken background that she did, she saw Chicago back then, you know, which was this booming city, as this kind of wonderland of all this material stuff that she had always been deprived of. According to her own sister, she was always, quote, money mad. Anyway, she ended up about 4 years after she got here, she married a guy named, by the way, her birth name was Brunhilde Storset. When she came over here, she changed it to Belle Peterson. And then she married a guy named Mads Sorensen, who was a night watchman at one of Chicago's big department stores. And they were married for about 8 years. You know, at some point they saved up enough money to open a little candy store. That burnt down. It was, the business wasn't really doing very well, and the candy store burnt down on somewhat mysterious circumstances. They collected insurance. You know, Bell was a big one for collecting insurance after various calamities happened. One thing about Bell that was very interesting, that everyone attested to and that her life seemed to confirm up to a certain point, is that she had a very powerful maternal instinct, and she always wanted to raise children. And somewhere during her marriage to Mads, one of their close friends, the wife gave birth to a child. They'd had a bunch of other children. They couldn't really afford to raise another. So Bell persuaded them to turn over the little girl to her as a foster child. And her name was Jenny. And somewhere along the way, she also became the mother of several other young children. A lot of mystery surrounds exactly the origin of those kids.
Right.
You know, Bell always claimed she gave birth to them, but she was pretty old at that point. and the evidence seemed to suggest that she got them from orphanages or, you know, took them in from other women who couldn't raise them. In any case, after she and Mads had been married about 8 years, Mads had a $2,000 life insurance policy, and Bell persuaded him that he needed a $3,000 life insurance policy. And there was one day where the two policies overlapped.
Oh.
You know, he didn't want to, like, even go one day with being uninsured.
Right.
So there was, you know, the last day of the $2,000 policy and the first day of the $3,000 policy, that day overlapped. And strangely enough,
he passed
Mads
away.
Came home from work that day, seeming hale and hearty, had dinner, and immediately took sick and died soon afterwards. You know, one thing I've learned from writing my books about the 19th century, I've done some of them, is how lucky we are to be living when we're living now in terms of medicine.
Right.
You know, because medicine was in a very primitive state of development even then. You know, the doctors decided that he had died of natural causes. And Bell came into this $5,000 payment, which was a substantial sum of money.
Right.
Back in it would have been 1907 or something. So she immediately went and purchased a farm. A large farm, I think it was about 140 acres, outside.
Is this the one?
Yes, that's it right there. LaPorte, Indiana. And she promptly married a handsome young man named Peter Gunness, who she knew. He had been a boarder at some point at the home of Mads and herself. So they were married. And about 8 months after their wedding, and this is after she had persuaded Peter Gunness to take out a sizable life insurance policy, he had a peculiar accident. It was his habit when he came home after his daily farm work to take off his boots and place them by the stove in the kitchen to dry out and warm up. And according to Bell's testimony, after dinner, he had bent down to get his boots. And when he raised himself up, he hit his head on a meat grinder that was standing on the edge of the stove and suffered this head injury that proved fatal. nobody ever heard of an accident like that before. There was a lot of suspicion. You know, that something fishy had gone on.
Right.
And they did an inquest and so on and so forth. Raised a lot of eyebrows, but ultimately there was no real proof that he had died in any other way. Her older daughter, Jenny, the one she had taken in years before, who was now this lovely adolescent, confirmed her story after a long consultation with her mother. So Belle, again, came into another sizable amount of money. But that's when her career of serial murder really began, because shortly thereafter, she began putting ads, classified ads, in Scandinavian language newspapers throughout the Midwest, basically saying that she was this widow with a wealthy, with a big farm. She was looking for a man, to come work it with her, with the possible prospects of marriage. But it was very important for him also to bring his life savings along so he can contribute to the upkeep of the property. Nobody knows exactly how many lonely Norwegian bachelors answered this, but it was quite a few. And at least a dozen of them would show up and then after a couple of days disappear. And Belle always had an excuse for why they left so abruptly.
They brought, most of these people brought cash because they didn't have a lot of checks and credit cards back then.
And she was always, there's some existing correspondence between her and these people. And she was always, she weeded out her potential victims. She was looking not only for lonely Norwegian bachelors with money, but preferably ones without any immediate family in the area. So all these guys disappeared. And then there was this man named Andrew Helgelian. And many letters exist still, that much of their correspondence still exists. And she spent a long time wooing him to Laporte. Her letters began rather formally. They quickly became very affectionate, very intimate. They're filled, with all these suggestions of the various marital pleasures he could look forward to. Belle was reputed to be a highly sexual person. Helgelian, would say he was going to come in a few weeks and then something would come up. He owned a big farm. He had to dispose of all his property. But he finally did show up. Oh, I have to interrupt myself. I left out one thing. Before Helgelian showed up, Belle had taken in a hired hand named, a local guy named Ray Lamphere, who worked for her and also shared her bed and came to expect that the two of them would get married. And a lot of the townspeople who saw them together all the time believed that they were going to get married too. As soon as Helgelian showed up, oh, there's Ray Lamphere right there. Yeah. As soon as Helgelian showed up, Belle banished Ray to the barn. And then one evening, a few days after, when Helgelian came, he didn't bring his money. He had left it in the bank. But as soon as he came, Belle went with him to the bank and arranged for all his savings to be transferred to Laporte. As soon as he had gotten his hands on them, he disappeared. And the night he disappeared, Belle had sent Lamphere off on a kind of wild goose chase to another town. She wanted to get him out of the way. She told him not to come back until the next day. But Lamphere got suspicious, and he snuck back to the farm on the night of Helgelian's disappearance. That proved to be very, very crucial later on. So what happened next was Helgelian's brother, Aisley, I think it was pronounced. I don't speak Norwegian. began to wonder where his brother had gone, he became very, very suspicious. And in looking over his brother's possessions, going over to his house, he found all these letters that had been written by this woman, Belle Gunness. So he contacted Belle. Belle made up some excuse about why, you know, she admitted he had come, that Andrew had come, but made up some excuse about why he had suddenly left. And you know, other people were starting to wonder about all these lonely Norwegian bachelors who had suddenly gone to La Porte and never returned. So Belle was feeling increasingly that the law was closing in on her. There's also some indication that when Ray Lamphere had returned unexpectedly home on the night that Belle sent him away, he witnessed her murdering Helgelian.
Oh, wow.
And was possibly blackmailing her. And she tried to get him, you know, she tried to get him arrested. She tried to get him thrown into an asylum. She really wanted to get him out of the way. On the night of, but I got to consult my notes so I get the exact date right. So, hold on. So on the night of April 27th, 1908, a fire broke out in Belle's home, and the entire house was completely obliterated. Hmm. You know, the only thing left was a cellar.
Right.
And the next day, after the ashes cooled sufficiently, searchers found in the cellar the body of a woman clutching the charred corpses of her three children.
Oh, no.
Oh, I left something else out. Sometime before that, Jenny, the oldest of her children, the beautiful foster child she'd taken in years before, these were the children who died in the fire with Belle.
Wow.
Well, who died in the fire? Jenny had disappeared sometime earlier. Belle told people that she had gone off to a seminary in California. And again, there's some indication that Jenny disappeared because she had become aware of what her mother was doing. So Belle's, you know, Belle's house burnt down. In the basement, they found this woman's charred body, the three incinerated bodies of these young children. And at first, the newspapers reported, you know, described her as a kind of heroic mother who had awakened in the middle of the night, found that the house was burning, grabbed her kids in order to rescue them, and then the whole thing collapsed on them. Mm. That changed when Andrew Helgelian's brother Aisley showed up at the farm, still trying to find out what had happened to his brother. And as he was walking around the property, he noticed there was this peculiar sort of indentation in the yard. And he got a shovel, dug it up, and discovered the dismembered remains of his brother. You know, the law was called. They started digging up the property. They found a dozen shallow graves. Wow. In the hog lot, each one containing the dismembered remains of a lonely Norwegian bachelor, one of the men who had answered Belle's ads and then vanished. And what Belle had done, evidently, was when they arrived, feed them. You know, she was always telling them what a great cook she was. She fed them this delicious Norwegian meal.
Oh, no.
Which they had been longing for in their nostalgia for home. You know, it was very, very easy to get hold of arsenic back in those days. She poisoned them And that night, while they were laying, you know, writhing in agony in bed, she apparently bludgeoned them and then took their bodies down to the basement or into the barn and dismembered them and then buried them in her hog lot.
Wow.
So, so immediately, you know, this became like the biggest news in the country.
Of course, yes.
You know, this that there was this murder farm out in the Midwest, you know, very close to Chicago. There was this monstrous woman who had lured at least a dozen men to their deaths, you know, killed them and dismembered them, and, you know, buried them in this horrible way in her hog lot. So, you know, and I mean, that's the basis for Bell's notoriety. Ultimately, what happened was that Ray Lamphere was accused of setting the fire, and he was tried, and he was found guilty of setting the fire, but not of murder. But the reason my book is subtitled The Mystery, yes, yeah, she was known as the female Bluebeard.
God.
Very unusual, by the way. I mean, there have been other serial killers, female serial killers, but I you know, Bell is really unique in that, you know, she butchered the bodies of her victims after murdering them. You know, that kind of desecration of corpses, you know, something you see far more commonly with male serial killers. But the reason my book is subtitled The Mystery of Bell Gunness is the female body that was found burnt in the cellar did not have a head attached.
Oh, really? So she, yeah. Oh, wow.
There was no head. So immediately stories began to spread that it wasn't Bell, you know, that she had lured some, Bell weighed about 250 pounds. She had lured some woman of her approximate stature to the farm and murdered her and used her as a decoy while she escaped. And even today, there are people who believe that Bell did not die in that fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tried to find, they knew that she had recently been to the dentist and gotten a bridge with some gold teeth in it. So they thought if they could find that, yeah, that would prove that it was Bell. And they, as it happened, there was a gold prospector who was named, inevitably, Old Klondike, who was living in the area. And they got him to set up this sluice. And he spent a week, you know, they were shoveling all these ashes through it. And they weren't finding anything. But the very last day before he was going to return to the Yukon, he found this, as that newspaper article showed, he found this bridge with his gold tooth in it. So people assumed it was Bell. However, you know, a lot of people felt that somebody as diabolically cunning as Bell could have easily planted that bridge there in order to, you know, for the exact purpose of covering her tracks. So.
Well, I'd like to go back because we're going to have some questions from the chat room here in a second on YouTube. Sure. But let's go back to when she was back in Norway. I don't know if you know much about that. I know when you do your research, I don't know how far you go back.
Yeah.
You know, she might be money hungry and that's all well and good, but that doesn't make somebody to become a killer or a serial killer of that. So,
yeah, no, you're totally right. And, you know, she had already, you know, realized a substantial amount of money from all these insurance scams.
Right.
He did on this big farm, which apparently was thriving. So, yeah, you're totally right. I mean, you know, she's a psychopathic killer who is obviously deriving some extreme perverted pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
From, you know, murdering these people. I mean, that's typical of serial killers. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that because a lot of times when you hear, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy and all these, it usually has some kind of sexual side to it. It's like a turn on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, serial killer, you know, when the term serial murder actually first was coined back in the 1930s to describe a very, very notorious, what they used to call lust murderer named Peter Curtin.
Right.
You know, but the term entered our language back in the late 80s or the early 80s. And it was used to describe, yeah, Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, Edmund Kemper, and these are all sex killers. Mm-hmm. You know, serial murder, you know, in that sense, is always a sex crime. It's sexual homicide. You know, these are extreme sexual sadists.
Right.
You know, derive very, very perverse pleasure from inflicting torture and death on helpless victims. So, yeah, I mean, the money was part of it for Bell. There's a mercenary aspect to it. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't explain why she was killing all these guys, you know, this horrible way. She was obviously deriving some kind of, one would have to say, erotic pleasure from it. Mm-hmm. But to go back to your question about her background, you know, the thing about a lot of these serial killers, particularly from the past, they're total non-entities. You know, and until they become infamous.
Right, right.
So, you know, there are very, very few records about their early lives. You know, after, and there are stories that circulate afterwards that have to be taken with a large grain of salt. I mean, there was one story that Bell, as a 16-year-old girl in Norway, had been impregnated by the son of a local landowner who then beat her and caused her to miscarry. You know, one factor that does operate in the minds of a lot of serial killers is extreme forms of childhood humiliation. And it's easy to imagine Bell, you know, who came from a particularly poor family,
right,
that was kind of looked down upon by other members of her community, you know, having suffered that. But ultimately, you know, we just don't know what caused her personality to warp the way it did.
Yeah, I was wondering if she had some type of abuse. I mean, back in the day, yeah, especially in the 1800s and early 1900s, women were not necessarily considered, you know, head of the household. They were sometimes just considered property to a lot of men.
Oh, yeah, I mean, she was, well, I mean, she, you know, she worked like a slave all during her childhood.
Right.
So, yes, I think you're right. I mean, as I said, I mean, some extreme forms of abuse, physical, sexual, psychological, are often found in the backgrounds, the childhood right. backgrounds of these mm-hmm. kinds of psychopathic killers.
And I think Danielle in the chat room also said, do all psychopaths have mental illness? I don't necessarily think all have mental illness. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, psychopathology itself, by definition, is kind of mental illness. I mean,
right, yeah.
People don't tend to use that term so much anymore. It's been replaced by antisocial personality disorder.
Right.
But, you know, but the hallmark of a psychopath is, you know, they're usually very intelligent people, very rational, but they employ their intelligence and rationality to these very, very, you know, diabolical ends. And they lack any empathy. They lack any sense of conscience. You know, they see other people as objects to be exploited for their own pleasures. And not all psychopaths are killers. You know, there's right. been a lot written about, you know, there's a book, The Psychopath Next Door. I mean, you know, there's some very successful lawyers who are psychopaths.
Right, right. Especially when they ask for your money.
But anyway, yeah. So.
Well, and I think, you know, a lot of times, like with anybody, when they feel so powerless, and mm-hmm. I think maybe the abuse from her childhood, mm-hmm. the money intrigue of money hungry, and then also taking back some power of, you yeah. know, controlling and killing these guys, that made her maybe feel more powerful,
yeah,
and it
absolutely.
Kind of an addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, power is very, very important, you know, because again, you have people who are treated so miserably as children, you know, they feel like they're nothing.
Right.
You know, this is the very, very sick way as they get older that they, you know, that they assert their own power, mm-hmm. you know, having this power, well, this ultimate power, the power of life and death over a helpless victim, you know, is very gratifying to them.
And you said that she did have, since, you know, her children were, you know, died in the fire, you know, allegedly, that she did have siblings that did get to probably be interviewed by people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did some of her siblings, maybe even parents, say about this? Because she died at a fairly young age, in her 40s.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You know, her parents were back in Norway. I'm not aware of, I don't even know if they were alive at the time. I mean, I just don't know what their opinion was. Her sister, Nellie, the one she moved into with when she lived in Chicago,
right.
You know, it's not uncommon. I've come across this again and again, for the siblings of these murderers, you know, to be very, very baffled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by their crimes. You know, again, one of the hallmarks of this kind of psychopathology is that people are, you know, wear a very, very convincing, what one psychologist calls, mask of sanity. You know, it's how they get along undetected in society. You know, there are some horrendous serial killers who are seemingly happily married and good fathers. And none of their coworkers would have any inkling that they were very, very, you know, sick people to that extent. So, you know, her sister was at a loss to explain it, other than, you know, to say that, you know, she attributed it to Bell's inordinate desire for money, you know, and going to any lengths to acquire it.
Right. Yeah. And do you feel that, due to, because we didn't have the technology, so, you know, social media, barely, very many people even had phones and mm-hmm. electricity back in the day, but do you contribute family follow-up is what really kind of caught the eye of the missing people? Because, you know, a lot of people may not have, if that one brother, I think, didn't find the letters, do you think they would have continued longer?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, Bell was pretty careful to make sure that the victim she lured to her farm did not have any relatives around. I don't know exactly how she missed Helgelian's brother. You know, it's hard to know how much longer she could have continued doing this anyway.
Right.
Again, particularly since Ray Lamphere seemed to have some knowledge of what she had done, at least to Helgelian. You know, she was very, very worried about Lamphere, which is why she tried to get him locked away and have him declared insane and so on and so forth. So it's hard to know. But yeah, I mean, you know, Helgelian's brother coming to the farm and start literally poking around the property is exactly what broke the whole case.
I was surprised, especially the Lamphere. Is that right, Lamphere?
Yes.
So it sounded like they kind of had some, at least a sexual relationship or some type of relationship.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like he had any money. So I'm curious to see why she would even be interested, other than if it was just some sexual desires to, you know, fill her need, because he didn't have any money, so that he was really no use of her other than for sex and farmhand.
Yeah, well, it's unclear that she intended to marry him.
Right.
You know, again, he did serve a sexual function, and he was a very competent farmhand.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as soon as Helgelian showed up, you know, he was in the barn. So, you know, he was easily disposable.
But do you think, because of her moving him back to the farm, that maybe jealousy did get the best of him, even though he, you know, she murdered again? That,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that she could have, that he could have actually chopped her head off and killed her.
Oh. Yeah, it's possible. I mean, what's interesting is that the jury did not find evidence that he had killed her, even though they found him guilty of burning the house, which is supposedly what caused her death.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
So it didn't make sense. But, you know, presumably if he had chopped off her head, there's no reason why the head wouldn't have been found.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
no mean, head was ever found.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, that does kind of sound strange that he would actually not only cut the head off, but he would take it with him or something. Like,
yeah. You know, if he decided to murder her and then burn down the house, again, I mean, there's no reason he would have chopped off her head.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. Danielle, also in the chat room, I'm going to just put this on the screen so you can see it. This is for you. How do you manage your feelings when dealing with these criminal information? I mean, that definitely would be a lot of information that's not always pretty to hear or see.
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. And certainly when I started writing these books, I was very disturbed by the material I was dealing with. But I always compare it to the way a medical student must feel, you know, the first few times he dissects a cadaver can be very, 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 very upsetting and nauseating and sickening and dizzying. And then after a while, you know, they're eating lunch while they're doing it. You know, you do become somewhat inured to these things. Excuse me. So yeah, I mean, I still find myself getting upset, you know, particularly when I think about, you know, the fate of the victims, you know, how some of them suffered. You know, some of the recent books I've written, you know, have to do with mass murderers who ended up killing children. So, you know, it's not that I have become totally desensitized to it. But again, I have become somewhat inured to it. You know, again, I've been writing these books for over 30 years.
Wow. Yeah. A long time. Why do you think people are, I mean, I'm so fascinating. I could sit and watch true crime or murder mysteries or serial killer, you know, even just on Netflix, they just released the John Wayne Gacy Netflix series. Why do you think we're so fascinated with this? I mean, it's not like it's a Disney movie, you know, that we're getting some type of fantasy. I guess maybe it is a fantasy in some ways, but in a positive way. Why do you think we're so fascinated?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think one thing that's important to realize, and I've written about this, is that there's nothing like new about true crime.
Right.
You know, one of the first books to come off the Gutenberg press back in the 1400s or 1300s, you know, was a true crime book. And in fact, the first book that was published in the in America, wasn't the United States back then, but in America, when the Mayflower Pilgrims came over, was a crime pamphlet. So, you know, human beings have always had an appetite to hear about, read about sensational murders and sensational crimes. You know, even before there was a printing press, there were things called murder ballads.
Oh, really?
Huh. Where, you know, whenever a particularly gruesome crime happened, somebody would create a little poem about it. And, you know, that would be transmitted orally.
Right.
So, you know, you'd have to say that it's material that appeals to, I mean, I think there are different reasons, you know, but one reason is, you know, the psychologist Carl Jung talks about all of us having a shadow side. You know, there's a, you know, all of us law-abiding, morally upright, you know, God-fearing people.
Right.
Still a part of us, you know, that is kind of fascinated by this dark, taboo, forbidden stuff. You know, we're unfortunately a violent species, and this is one of the ways that part of ourselves gets a little bit of gratification. So I definitely think that's a big part of it.
And I agree. I agree that, you know, we're, I think human beings are so complicated sometimes. It's hard to, I couldn't even imagine being a psychiatrist or psychologist to dissect the human mind.
Yep.
Because, I mean, you can look at, you know, politicians and religious leaders and dictators. I mean, Hitler, even Hitler, they, you know, behind the scenes to his family, he was apparently a pretty good guy. But then in the world itself, he was not. So it is kind of crazy how we could. Well, No Baloney Mahoney has a question for you. Said, long ago, I read a thin book entitled Cop's Diaries. Has Harold heard of it? Have you heard of it?
I have not, but I will. But if you recommend it, I will take a look at it. Most of my writing, by the way, I mostly write historical true crime. So all my books really have been about both serial murders and mass murders that have taken place, you know, back into the mid 19th century and up through, let's say, the 1950s. Mm. Have written this encyclopedic work, The Serial Killer Files, in which I deal, you know, with more recent cases. But in terms of the books that I do a lot of research and spend a couple of years writing, those are all more historical cases. And I have to say that this partly goes back to an earlier question. At this point in my life, I don't read a lot, except for, you know, the material I'm working on.
Right.
Read a lot of true crime or see true crime documentaries. You know,
yeah.
It's just like too much for me. So,
well, I mean, it's like, you know, we talk about UFOs and all kinds of paranormal stuff on my show. And, mm-hmm. you know, now there's so many different, even they have a true crime channel that's just 24/7 of true crime, which is fascinating. You know, I was also, Netflix has really, I think, brought true crime to, you know, kind of the mainstream when it comes to miniseries and stuff like that. In fact, mm-hmm. you may know this lady, mm-hmm. Dorothea. She kind of reminds me of Belle, you know, where she would, you know, get these homeless people that get Social Security checks. They get, you know, she gets them in, poison or kill them, bury them in the backyard, and keep getting the checks. So that's kind of...
Yeah, well, there have been a few. I don't know if you know the movie. There's a famous movie, I guess, back in the 40s called Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, I don't, huh?
A Cary Grant movie, a comedy. But it's about these dotty old ladies who run a home for the elderly and poison them with elderberry wine. But that movie was based on a real person.
Oh, wow.
Who also, again, ran a home for the aged, collected their Social Security checks, and then poisoned them. There have been quite a few female serial poisoners in our history.
Hmm. It sounds like, I mean, very similar. Sounds like, you know, hey, well, I got your money and I got some checks coming in, so nobody needs to know. It'd be harder to do nowadays, I think, but maybe.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, but back then, I mean, I was just writing about a female serial killer. She was known as the Poison Fiend. You know, some of these people, you know, this one woman poisoned about six of her own children.
Oh, my God.
And several of her husbands. You know, they poison people who are close to them very often. And one of the things I have come to believe is that, you know, when you think of, like, the first modern serial killer was Jack the Ripper.
Right.
You know, you think of Jack the Ripper, this horrible butcher. But actually, Jack the Ripper killed his victims very, very swiftly. You know, he slit their throats.
Right.
You know, all the atrocities he committed were done post-mortem.
Hmm.
Whereas some of these female poisoners derive a lot of sadistic pleasure, you know, from making their victims suffer.
Wow.
Protracted deaths. Some of them are more extreme sadists than, like, Jack the Ripper in that sense.
Before we get out of here, I mean, from all the people you've researched and maybe even not researched, like you said, a serial killer, and I'm not trying to, you know, make anybody's killings less than the other, or, you know, less brutal. But is there one serial killer that you can think of that was so brutal, and it's not even the amount of people that they've killed, but the brutality of killing? Who do you think that would be?
Yeah, that's an easy one for me to answer. It goes back to what I was saying before when the person asked if I ever get disturbed by this.
Right.
So the second book I wrote was about a guy named Albert Fish. Albert Fish, you know, is among aficionados of this kind of thing, you know, often thought of as like the most heinous serial murderer in American history. And that's because he was, oh, there he is.
He's a scary looking one.
Well, you know, he was an extreme sexual sadist who preyed on children. Nobody knows exactly how many he killed, but he would just lure children to these places and subject them to the most hideous kinds of tortures and before he killed them. And, you know, he would always experience extreme sexual ecstasy while he was doing it. His final victim was this beautiful 12-year-old girl that he murdered, dismembered, then brought a bunch of her flesh back home to his boarding house and made it into a stew.
Wow.
And ate it. So yeah, I would say Fish. And writing that book was very, very disturbing to me.
Yeah, and I was just reading as the Gray Man, the Werewolf of Wisteria, the Brooklyn Vampire, the Moon Maniac, and the Boogeyman. The Boogeyman would definitely be a one that probably describes him well.
So he was operating, well, it's hard to know when he began.
Right.
You know, they finally captured him in the early 30s. But he had spent 50 years torturing children all across the country.
Wow. Well, Harold, you're going to have to come back and discuss some of your other books. I mean, this was great, and great storyteller, and putting, you know, like you said, putting that on paper, I think would give you some creepy nights sometimes just to, you know, Absolutely. Be able to hear some of this stuff. But would you come back and talk about other books?
Pleasure. Anytime.
Awesome. Well, how do people find you, buy your books, and all that good stuff?
Well, best place to buy them is Amazon.
Right.
You can find me. I do have a website, which
it's right below you.
HaroldShechter.com.
Yep.
I'm not on Facebook, but I do have a Facebook page, and people can contact me there. I have somebody who transmits those messages, and I'm always very careful to answer them. So
perfect. Well, today we're talking about Hell's Princess, The Mystery of Belle Gunness and Butcher of Men. And how many books total do you have?
Well, you know, not all my books are serial killer books.
Right.
As you pointed out, I was a professor. You know, I wrote some academic books. But I've written and or edited, over 40.
Wow. That's a
lot. You know, but I'm an old guy. So.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations and thank you again. And I know everybody in the chat room that's listening, they loved it. And, you know, there's movies out there about her, Belle. The books are out there, so pick up the books. And, again, thank you guys for tuning in to Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet. You can always watch Robert Hensley on Monday, Minuteman Report, Bonnie Burkett on Wednesdays for Truth Be Told Transformation. And, of course, little old me on Fridays at 3 o'clock. You never know what we're going to talk about, but it always has something to do with true crime or paranormal. So until next time, we'll see you then. And please like, share, and make sure you leave a positive comment about our amazing guest. All right, take care, and we'll see you next week.
This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBN Go Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media. Facebook?
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
Chumba. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Truth Be Told Radio. Instagram. Truth Be Told Paranormal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows.